عليك قول لمن ملك لبيك قد لبيت لك.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
سبحانه ما أعظم والملك لا شريك له لبيك إن الحمد لك والعز لا
شريك. 6 p.m. Washington time.
Part 2.
In September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter and the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
America, it's hard time.
The U.S. State Department argued against it. Their first response was, no country, no state.
No mandate, no medina.
The situation was not good at all, so the Prime Minister of Israel, Moshe Sharet, was sent to the United States so that he might be able to change the strong-willed United States Secretary of State's opinion on the recognition of the State of Israel. But George Marshall did not agree at all. Marshall went to the White House to talk to Harry S. Truman, and he realized that the president did not agree with him and had different ideas about Israel. Clark Clifford, the White House counsel, was also present in that meeting.
General Marshall started off. The president listened attentively and then said, I would like now to hear from Clark. But as I spoke, I saw Marshall's face getting redder and redder.
George Marshall realized that Truman supported Israel for two reasons: Zionist money and votes in the upcoming elections. And Truman mentioned this point explicitly. However, Marshall tried to make Truman aware of the consequences of his decision.
We are in the midst of a very critical situation. We should, therefore, carefully avoid approaching international problems on an emotional basis.
Finally, Marshall said that if Truman recognized the Israeli interim government, he would not support his candidacy in the upcoming elections. But 2 days later, on May 14, 1948, the leaders of the Jewish National Council went to this building, the Tel Aviv Museum, to proclaim the establishment of an independent Jewish state. The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The chief of staff of the Israeli army, General Yitzhak Rabin, called on Foreign Minister Abba Eban to find a diplomatic solution to the issue, because Israel was not ready for war as it should be. On May 25, 1967, Eban went to the United States to know the U.S.'s opinion about their new problem.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
do you want
of
the United
law.
States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
Lyndon B. Johnson, then President of the United States, told Eben that he did not want Israel to start a war. During this meeting, Johnson read part of the secret document to Eben. The document stated that Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go alone. The Soviet Union said the same words to Egypt and urged them not to start a war. In practice, however, Egypt did start the war by closing the Strait of Tiran to Israel. The commanders in the Egyptian war room warned that if they wanted to wait for the attack, the first attack would be crippling for Egypt, and the chief of staff commented that if they allowed Israelis to carry out the first attack, they would only fight Israel. But if Egyptians started the attack, in addition to Israel, they must also fight the United States. Same days, Hussein bin Talal, King of Jordan, visited Abdel Nasser and assured him that he was still disgusted with Israel and ready for a possible war and would help Egypt in the war against Israel. Hussein and Nasser signed a bilateral defense agreement, and Hussein practically ordered his army at the behest of Egypt. The situation became difficult for Israel. Egypt from the south, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north were ready to attack Israel. Levi Eshkol was in crisis and wanted to know whether or not the United States had any plans to open the Strait of Tiran. But the United States was trapped in the purgatory of Vietnam War and had no patience for new troubles in the Middle East. Eshkol was disappointed with the U.S. support and, in consultation with his new defense minister, General Moshe Dayan, chose June the 5th to attack Egypt. 7 o'clock in the morning, 180 Israeli fighters flew towards Egypt, and only 12 of them remained to defend the Israeli airspace. Forty-five minutes later, the runways of the Egyptian military airports were bombed and all the Egyptian fighters were targeted by Israeli rockets on the ground without even having a chance to start their engines. The Egyptian Air Force was completely destroyed. The Syrian and Jordanian air forces were also hit by these surprise attacks. Sinai Desert, Egyptian tanks were three times more than Israeli tanks, but there was no air cover for the Egyptian ground forces. The Egyptians had no choice but to withdraw. Egypt's defense minister, General Amr, ordered the withdrawal of their forces from the Sinai Desert, but there was no plan to retreat. As a consequence, Egyptian forces went towards the Suez Canal without any specific plan. Israeli fighters also took advantage of this opportunity and destroyed the Egyptian forces. This unplanned retreat damaged the Egyptian army. The Israelis have told Jordanians that they would not be in danger if they did not intervene in this war. At 10:30, Jerusalem al-Quds was hit by Jordanian artillery shells. The Jordanian attack was unsuccessful and the resistance of King Hussein's forces in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds did not last more than 10 hours. Jordan had the control of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank, but after the war, lost the control to Israel. It was Syria's turn after Jordan and Egypt. Israeli binoculars had control of the heights bordering Israel and Syria. After 12 hours of intense fighting, Israel captured the Golan Heights. The Soviet Union had already started a war with a false news. When the Soviet Union witnessed Israel attacking its communist ally, Syria, it gave an ultimatum to Israel's supporter, the United States, announcing that it was seeking military support for Syria. This was not just a bluff. Ukrainian jet fighters were ready by the order of the Soviet Union. The Soviet-American Cold War tension reached one of its most complicated moments. Lyndon B. Johnson and his colleagues had a meeting at the White House to find an answer to the Soviet ultimatum. He wrote to Kremlin that he would use every opportunity to stop the Israeli war machine, but in practice, instead of calling the Israeli prime minister in a formal action, he told the U.S. representative to the UN to talk to the Israeli representative. The U.S. envoy saw the Israeli representative at the lobby and gave him the message.
United States Ambassador Goldbeck asked me to come out into the lobby and to say to me, you must immediately announce that the fighting is over.
But this was not within the power of the Israeli ambassador to the UN. The Israeli representative talked to Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eben about the issue. Eben immediately called Eshkol's house to tell him that the international pressure had increased and he had to stop the war as soon as possible at the request of the U.S. But Eshkol was watching the beauties of the Golan Heights with his commanders at the time. His wife gave him Eben's important message.
Eshkol, listen. Ivan wants you to stop the war. He can't take the pressure. He said, I can't hear you. What do you mean you can't hear me? I'm telling you in Ivan's exact words. He says, I can't hear you, I can't hear you. It's a bad line, it's a bad line.
But the Prime Minister did not consider the message and continued his work. Eben realized that Eshkol needed more time to advance on Syrian territory. It exactly happened, and they reached all their goals in Syria. Israeli ambassador to the UN received the text of the agreement. He had to read it aloud to the UN Security Council. This was the end of the war.
Israel accepts any proposal made by General Burr for the implementation of the Security Council ceasefire resolution and the arrangements for the supervision of the ceasefire.
Israel volunteered for peace because it had large areas of land to exchange. The Golan Heights from Syria, Old City of Jerusalem al-Quds, the West Bank from Jordan, as well as the Sinai Desert and Gaza from Egypt. The Israelis were ready to return the Golan Heights to Syria and the Sinai Desert to Egypt. But they had an important condition for peace, and that was acceptance and recognition of the independent state of Israel by the Arabs. Eben went to the United States to discuss Israel's offer with the Americans, but recognizing Israel was not something that Gamal Abdel Nasser and the rest of the Arabs wanted. The hero of the Egyptian people, who could neither make peace with Israel nor had the power to stop their military machine, had no choice but to resign. People were shouting, either Nasser or no one else, in Cairo. They were not satisfied with the resignation of Gamal Abdel Nasser. Nasser remained Egyptian president, but did not comply with the Soviet-U.S. peace agreement. In September of 1967, Arab leaders gathered at the Khartoum summit and said, no peace with Israel, no negotiations with Israel, no recognition of Israel. Of course, the Arabs did not have other alternatives, and Israel did not return the occupied territories to them. On September the 28th, 1970, after the end of the emergency meeting of the Arab summit, Gamal Abdel Nasser felt a pain in his chest. He died the same night in front of Anwar Sadat's eyes. So the vice president became the president of Egypt, and many thoughts were running through his mind. 6 years had passed since the Israeli occupation of Sinai, and Egypt's third president dreamed of retaking a piece of land that had fallen to the Zionists during the Six-Day War. Sadat continued Nasser's strategy, so a new war was on the horizon. Sadat started the game with the Soviet Union. The U.S. supported Israel, and Egypt needed the support of the opposite pole. The Soviet Union played its trump card, shifting the balance of power in favor of Egypt. The Soviet Union prepared some advanced missiles, missiles that could challenge the security of Israeli jet fighters. Everything was ready for a new war. Egyptian SAM missiles were ready to target any Israeli element within 15 miles of the Suez Canal. Anwar al-Sadat was not alone in this war, and Syrian President Hafez al-Assad was with him. The attack had to take place in complete surprise. The promised day was chosen in the Allied front, and Syria from the east and Egypt from the west started attacking Israel, and the targets were again the Golan Heights and Sinai. Yom Kippur means Day of Atonement in Hebrew. This day is one of the most important holidays in the Jewish calendar. Jews attend synagogue four times on Yom Kippur and pray. Egypt was aware of this. On October the 6th, 1973, as the Zionists were waking up to prepare for the festival, they were hit by surprise attacks on two fronts of Sinai and the Golan Heights, the same areas occupied by Israel in the Six-Day War in 1967. The first decision of the Israeli war room was to let the jet fighters counter the aggression, and the permission was in the hands of one person, Israel's fourth prime minister, Golda Meir. But she did not give the permission. Meir believed that if Israel wanted to attract international attention after the Six-Day War, it had to be recognized as a victim of Yom Kippur aggression. The war had begun. The Egyptian commandos crossed the Suez Canal under their own heavy artillery fire and entered the Sinai Desert. At 4 p.m., the first Israeli fighters were allowed to fly, but as soon as they approached the Suez Canal, they were destroyed by some missiles. Inevitably, the Israeli tanks started attacking, but the Egyptians had thought about that too. The Sagar anti-tank missile made Sinai a graveyard for Israeli tanks. Sagar anti-tank guided missiles were again the result of Egyptian friendship with the Soviet Union.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
According to a United Nations World Food Program WF report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Robin Scher, writer. This article is published under the heading, Pandemic may have left 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. Here's more. According to a United Nations World Food Program report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. The combined effect of the pandemic as well as the emerging global recession could, without large-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and a scale unseen for more than half a century, states another UN report. In the United States, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children due to the pandemic, states a June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research, IPR, at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. In a recent interview with CBS News, IPR Director Dionne Whitmore warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Latino families. Indeed, families of color are being disproportionately impacted. According to an analysis of new census data by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, 22% of Black and 21% of Latino respondents reported not having enough to eat, compared to just 9% with white people. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, WFP Director David Beasley told the UN Security Council in April 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. He added, "In a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about 36 countries, and in fact, in 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation." The number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about eight times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date, wrote Mark Lowcock, the Under Secretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and Alex Van Trottenberg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank. Countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stunt whole generations. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminished food safety. The same might be said about the pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children and young people have been affected. Schools provide a food lifeline for children. For so many, that is where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, UNICEF and WFP released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in school meals have been missed worldwide since the pandemic began, with 370 million children worldwide having missed 40% of in-school meals. In early 2020, when COVID-19 was still a looming specter rather than the deadly virus we are more familiar with today, the threat of food insecurity was a practical problem. Scenes of shoppers descending on aisles to stock up on supplies was a common sight. As CNN reported in March 2020, supermarkets around the world rationed food and other products such as toilet paper and cleaning supplies in an effort to curb stockpiling. In Vermont, for instance, a steady increase in food insecurity since the start of the pandemic has correlated to employment levels, according to a survey conducted by the University of Vermont between March and April 2020. Approximately 45% of respondents had either lost their jobs, been furloughed, or had their hours reduced during the pandemic. And a further two-thirds of survey participants who recorded scarcity of food in their households had experienced job losses or work disruptions since the outbreak of the pandemic, according to the survey. Vermont is just one example. The impact has been felt across the U.S. during the week before Thanksgiving last year. The Guardian reported that 5.6 million U.S. households struggled to put enough food on the table, while referring to the analysis of the census data by CBPP. As the pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain, with factory and supermarket workers being highly susceptible to COVID-19. There has been a commitment decline in food production and a rise in prices. As Scott Faber, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at Environmental Working Group, EWG, reported, farmers across the U.S. were already facing labor shortages prior to the pandemic. And with tightened immigration as well as the heightened risk and poor compensation associated with these jobs, food processors and farm labor contractors may struggle to find other workers willing to risk their lives to work in meat plants, packing sheds, or produce fields. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. The monstrous and unsustainable food industry known as Big Ag relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch, can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressure during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America. April M. Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote in Salon, "Among the many necessary systematic changes, 2020 has illuminated the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities. It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, while nearly 690 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the pandemic has underscored matter. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million due to COVID-19, representing an 82% increase compared to the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19. And the disruption of transportation has shown that the long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. Food banks are under tremendous pressure to meet the skyrocketing demand, wrote Claire Bainbow-Fonaut, Feeding America CEO, and Zippy Duval, president of the American Farm Bureau to then-Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue in April of last year. At the same time, however, we are seeing literally tons of agricultural goods being discarded because of the shutdown of so much of the economy. Consumer demand has shifted from eating out at restaurants and food services away from home, and food supply chain operations have had to be retooled. And that impact has been felt within the transportation sector. Forbes reported that Andrew Novoik, an agricultural economist at Cornell University, points to a number of weak spots in the food transportation system that could be aggravated by the increased demand for food. A shortage of truck drivers is one potential weak spot, says Novoik. Although he concedes there is debate on this matter, he maintains that trucking companies are finding it much harder to recruit those long-haul drivers. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June 2020. While the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed, the OECD report states. The biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity. And our problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era. As The Economist recently pointed out, journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision contest, but only around 2,000 about drought and hunger in Zambia.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And to help us with these questions for our dear ones, the future of our community, we have with us Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Sayyid Abdullah, salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. It's always nice to have you with us.
Wa alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And it's always a pleasure being here with you.
All right, so Sayyid, let's talk about natural disasters today. I'm going to start with a story I have myself. I remember once I was visiting my cousin, and that night there was an earthquake. And no one sensed that earthquake except his five-year-old child. And we had a very serious problem trying to calm this child down all the way till the morning that he was not going to be buried under a pile of rubble. especially that he had heard from the news that there are chances that there will be more earthquakes coming. It happens that we're living in this era of the COVID pandemic as well, and I'm guessing that a lot of children out there are worried that they'll catch the virus, or that their dear ones will catch the virus and they'll lose, for instance, their parents. So a lot of parents might be struggling. How can we give comfort to our children, Sayyid Abdullah?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. So like you mentioned in your story, so with earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, natural disasters, even these days viruses and biological warfare, whatever it is that they might be going through. The thing is, the kids these days are exposed to a lot of material or materials in this regard, either online or either on the media, or either naturally, like depends on what you, where you are, where you live, the geographic place you're situated in. It could be subjected to earthquakes, for example, or it could be subjected to, I don't know, hurricanes or floods, or just viruses, basically. So it depends. So it depends on the level of exposure on the child. That will definitely leave an impact when it comes to the anxiety, when it comes to the depression, and when it comes to the mental state and mental health. So that really affects them. So it depends on how much they're exposed, the more that fear will increase. So, for example, that story that you said about the child that you had an experience with, if he's exposed to too much earthquake material and videos, for example, and he's seen what happens to people when earthquake happens. So all these images, all this information comes to mind, and he thinks it's going to happen to him. So naturally, his natural response would be fear, and he would be crying out of fear and out of anxiety, and he would want some sort of safety. Right?
And there's no use talking sense to them. Like, talking science is not going to work. Because I tried that and it didn't work.
No, see, the thing is, like, even scientifically, that the children, because their brains haven't developed, their brains mature at the age of, like, somewhere in the 20s, their full brain matures. So trying to debate with them or trying to do comfort them or talk to them in a scientific way at their level, it definitely not going to work. It might make sense to them. They're like, oh, okay, makes sense, but they will not understand. That's why, for example, we have syllabus and the textbooks in our schools. They start slowly trying to build their information as they get to, you know, a higher age. So in this case, instead of trying to explain to him scientifically what an earthquake is, try to give him a bit of comfort. Just give him a hug and say, you know what, let's go for a walk where there's no building, there's nothing. So he feels more safe.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to take a break now, but we'll be back after the break to further our discussion. Don't go away.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing with Sayyid Abdullah. And we're talking about how to give comfort to our children in the face of natural disasters, whether it's earthquakes or viruses. Before the break, you said that so you can't talk science to them because it might make sense to them, but their imagination is too powerful to convince them. We have to give them some other kind of comfort. One day my friend said that I saw a child who was worried about riding a plane, and he said to his mother that because it goes too fast. And instead of explaining the physics of flying, the mother said, okay, I'll tell the captain to fly slowly. And that comforted the child. So how can we give comfort to our children in the face especially of COVID and of any natural disaster that our area might be subject to?
Well, that's precisely like the example they gave at the mother. You have to try to calm them down in a simple, easy way they can understand. Because sometimes, like, we are not, the story they gave about the mother, sometimes we are not, we don't think that far ahead, right? Our thinking is very complicated, so we're trying to find a complicated solution. But sometimes you need to bring your level down. For example, we say, how do you get an elephant in a fridge, right? So if you want to think of it from an adult perspective, it's like, that's impossible. from a child perspective, people says, open the door, put the elephant in, close the door. There you go.
There you go.
He's it. So you need to think it like from a child brain. So like the mother, like, I'll tell the captain to sort the plane, mm-hmm. right? So that gave him a bit of comfort. So sometimes giving the child the comfort that he needs, that's all there is to it. So it and then like also depends on the child himself, because we don't have an antidote that fits all, right? So sometimes a simple word could work with a child. Sometimes it's two words, sometimes it's three, sometimes it's a sentence, right? So it depends on the child that you're dealing with. But the idea is that what you need to do is keeping them calm. That's it. It's like even the planes themselves, like when they go through turbulence, and if God forbid something happens to the plane, when they release the gas masks, actually it's been said, I've read this somewhere, these gas masks, all they do is they actually put you to sleep. I'm not sure how true that is. Maybe you can help me out. So they push you to sleep. Not push you to sleep, but they relax you.
Calm
you, right?
Down.
They try to calm you down. So they have, I don't know what they put in these things, these gas, but it calms you down. Because what? Because you're now in a panic state. Sometimes being in the panic state itself is that what kills you. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that if you throw a person off a building, he actually dies before he hits the ground,
yeah.
right? Because of the heart panic attack. And the pain and the heart attack. So sometimes the fear itself, it's what annoys the person, hurts the person. So sometimes it's just a matter of calming them down. You need to calm them down in a way you think is suitable for the child. Because I can't say, what should you say? Or what should you do?
Mm-hmm. Can you give us steps to like first approach the child? And also another issue is that we don't want them to get too calm. For instance, in regards to a pandemic, to go touching everywhere and not being careful of anything.
Now, that's a different, like I said, it's from one case scenario to another differs, right? So, for example, since we're dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, there is a sense of education is required, a sense of calmness is required, and a sense of education is required. For example, comfort them that everything is going to be all right, everything is fine, there's nothing to worry about, you are safe, you're still healthy, you're still strong. This virus, for example, does not affect you. It affects older people, those who are sick, blah, blah, blah. And like just in a simple way. And also you educate them in taking into measures in their own hands. For example, wash your hands, don't touch this, don't touch that, and so on and so forth. You know, the things that we've been told to do, mm-hmm. even as adults. Mm-hmm. And you see kids these days are doing them as well. So you need to educate them, at the same time give them that assurance of that comfort as well. So you can't just rely on one thing and neglect the other.
All right, thank you very much. Let's take a short break now, and we'll be back after the break to further our discussion.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So we're talking about how to comfort our child in the face of natural disasters and pandemics. We said that, first of all, talking about science is not going to work, because it might make sense to them, but it will not convince them. Their imagination is too powerful for that. Secondly, we said that we should try to comfort them by assuring security for them and safety for them. And in some cases, we also need to educate them, like wash your hands if we're talking about the pandemic. What further advice can you give parents to deal with their children?
Okay. The main advice we give to parents to deal with kids who are going through disasters of some sort, be it earthquakes, floods, or viruses and stuff like that. The first thing we need to do is we need to limit their access to TV and internet and media, right? Because this is where it's mainly is caused by, right? So now if you go online or on TV and social media, the first thing you get bombarded with is this COVID-19 nonsense, right? So this is how much people got killed. This is how many people have contracted the virus today. and numbers, right? And that scares the Jesus out of the kids, right? So what happened is that you need to limit this kind of information. And mind you, there are a lot of evil people at play. They're using this pandemic as a way to, you know, do their agendas or spread their agendas. So not everything that you see on TV is innocent. Doesn't matter which country. I will gladly go through every single country. I don't care what they call themselves, Islamic or not Islamic. They get bombarded with all these things, right? With all these pictures, with all these people dying and numbers and stuff like that. So they naturally get scared. And then their response to such a thing might, you know, be not what we expect them to do. So what we need to do is limit their access to social media as much as possible. Because this is where the problem is to begin with. If that's limited, then everything makes sense. And then, it's just, like I said, it's just a matter of educating them of how to deal with certain things. And depending on where you are geographically, then you need to deal with the problem at hand. For example, if you're in a country right now where, you know, the majority of the disaster seems to be the virus itself, try to educate your child not to touch things, not to get in contact with other people, keep their distancing, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, you need to limit that media access to the actual problem itself.
Then they'll get distracted and they'll forget. They won't feel it as much.
You know, like he will wash his hands and he will keep his distance just naturally, not out of fear. Because, you know, I've seen a lot of people, even grown-ups, like they are scared to walk out. They're scared to go shopping. I'm like, why? That's because they get to see so much material and so much information online and on media that it really scares them. It puts them in a fear that he thinks, you know what, I can't touch a person. I can't touch this. I can't touch that. I can't, you know. I've seen people, like, they take their, you know, they whatever they touch, they have to wash and they have to. I'm like, you're going a bit overboard. We see that everybody is scared for no reason. And that's, like I said, the number one reason is the media. So you open the TV, once the news, the first thing they say, well, thousands of people got this virus, this number got killed, and so on and so forth. So obviously, you get scared.
All right,
so limit that to kids, especially with kids. It magnifies the fear. So you need to limit their access to media as much as possible. That would give them a sense of assurity and a sense of calmness.
All right, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. If you missed the program, don't worry. You can always download this episode and all the previous ones from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, click on Call of Islam, and you'll find Islamic upbringing right there. You can also visit our accounts on social media services. Search Call of Islam Radio on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Telegram. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.